great duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? You know the routine. I'm drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and getting my head right for the journey ahead. I'm self-medicating, people, because I reflect upon the totality of humanity's many mistakes against itself and its own environment in exchange for a rigidly controlled concoction of convenience and servitude, and I just have to take the edge off. But it's a good day to be alive. Guy McPherson is here, a listener in the subreddit requested Guy, offering a $100 bounty for the money bomb, so I delivered. Now it's your move, man. But also, Guy is a great follow-up to Michael Rupert. Mike cited Guy a few times in our interview, and I'm a big fan. He's been teaching and writing about the damage we've done to our planet for a long time, and I would say in this conversation, I had the vast damage we've done to the planet explained to me better than it ever has been. And it's fucking shocking, guys. But I think that's the only way we can move on to other systems. We need to understand the extent of our current failure. When you really lay out the themes that make up THC, economic slavery, the censorship of history, science, and so many other fields, today's topic included, the mind control elements of mass media and Hollywood, Gnostic wisdom, corruption in our leadership and longstanding institutions, the destruction of our health and pharmaceutical companies, a fucked up medical system and corporate farming that produces what seems more like the equivalent of wet socks than nutrient-rich fruits and vegetables. But all these subjects, all this damage and deceit on this show, I point these things out not to stir up fear or to drown you in negativity. I point these things out so that when we hear the mantra of the machine that repeats that this is the best system we have, we recognize that for the bullshit it is, and it sounds dumber to us every day. And I want people to understand, hell, I want to understand myself how bad it is, how integrated it is, how all-encompassing it is, so we can know that any proposal that comes short of halting all the damage done by the machine, any solution that doesn't reel back all the power and all those corrupt systems that channel it from humanity and the planet itself, those solutions aren't going to save us. Say what you will about the Zeitgeist movement or the Venus Project, but the solutions we need are going to be so radically different, it's going to be fucking scary. And it's going to be a gamble. And the more information we have about the absolute worldwide grid of control and exploitation, the more apparent it becomes that this system is beyond being tweaked, and the closer we collectively get to taking that gamble. And that's what I want. I want to see us roll the dice on something, and hopefully the conversations we've had on the Higher Side Chats move you closer to that realization. I know today's with Guy McPherson has made an impact on me. Hopefully you'll feel the same. Now, I do want to say Guy had a bit of an audio issue. He took our conversation from a study room at the University of Arizona's library, and the room was a little too big and empty, which gave us some echo. That said, I sent the file over to a listener named Dave, who emailed me many moons ago and said if I ever had some audio that needed cleaning up, he would happily take a crack at it, and I think he did a bang-up job. So thanks, Dave. Dave actually runs a website called Looperstar, where he does several music-related things and sells some pretty slick-looking guitar pedals. I don't know anything about guitar pedals, but I just know the guy fixed up this audio in a day and sent it back to me. And I think it's a huge improvement, and the file I sent him actually had cut off the first few minutes of our conversation. So you'll notice that after about the five-minute mark, Guy's side of the conversation sounds a whole lot clearer, and that's thanks to Dave. It's also just part of having a Skype and phone-based show. There's only so much you can do to control the quality on the guest's end. And I'm going on, but it's really not even that bad. And the content is so important that I often got lost in it without even noticing. But I just want to give a shout-out to Dave for the hookup. Here's a little spot for the Money Bomb, which is sitting at a kind of low $85, I believe, at my last count. And this next one is episode 100, so I really hope we can blow it out of the water for the 100th show. And I know we will. It's been a huge success so far, and I couldn't be happier. So thanks all to you who donate. That said, let's get it going, and we'll be on the other side with the almighty Guy McPherson. Hey people, I gotta take a second to tell you about something we do around here called the THC Money Bomb. What I do is every 5 episodes, I total up the donations I've gotten in that period of time, and half keeps me and the show going. I take the other half and I gift that back to a random listener. So far we're hitting about 500 each round and I couldn't be happier about it. So consider throwing in 5 or 10 bucks. It's cheaper than a hand at the blackjack table with better odds than a scratch-off ticket. Plus, you know half supports a show you like, and at the very least, half will go to a like-minded person who could probably use a nice surprise in these troubled times. When you make a donation, I can see your email address, and that's how I pick the winner. But to keep things kosher, you can also get in the pool by sending your info on a postcard to me, Greg Carlwood, P.O. Box 635223, San Diego, California, 92163. I got no subscription fees here, no paid archives, no paid bonus shows, and I want to keep it that way, on principle. But I'm not a millionaire at the podcast on the side. This is it for me. And I'm the only one I know who's trying to help the people out as well.
That's my man!
So help me help you. If you want to play along, go to thehiresidechats.com/donate and get in the game. Dollars, bitcoins, it's all good to me. And that's what we call the THC Money Bomb. Boom. Folks, it doesn't take much insight to see that our philosophy of infinite growth and expansion is not sustainable on a finite planet, and if you're like me, you can feel it in the air that these are very troubled times, as many researchers are starting to feel as though we've already passed the point of no return. There's a lot of noise and wishful thinking on the subject, but today, people, I'm looking for the facts, and we got just the man to give them to us. Today's guest is Guy McPherson, who is a retired professor of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona, and the author of several books, including Going Dark and Walking Away from Empire. He's also the man behind the blog Nature Bats Last. Fresh off an appearance on Conspiracy HQ with our friend Rob Davin, Guy is the man when it comes to analyzing the damage humanity is inflicting on the Earth and monitoring the ongoing changes that result from our self-destructive path. And I, for one, can't wait to have my day ruined. Guy McPherson, how the hell are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on the show today.
Of course, it's a real pleasure, man, and I'm half kidding about the day-ruining thing. Obviously, no one wants to hear negative doom and gloom all day, every day, but unfortunately, on this show, I like to hear the real deal, so that sometimes puts me in a contradictory position, but what can you do, right?
Yeah, I'm meeting with a friend tomorrow, having breakfast with her, and she was the founder of Poetry Inside Out, a program I participated in for several years. And she used to call me that exact thing. She'd call me Dr. Day Ruiner.
I had Michael Rupert on the show a few weeks back, and it was one of those episodes where the audience got real vocal with me about their thoughts on it. Most didn't want to hear it, but there were opinions on both sides, and Mike cited your work several times, and I've enjoyed hearing you speak on some of these topics, so I'm real happy we could do this. But of all the topics we cover, the idea that we've done too much damage on the planet at this point to recover without some massive human die-off, it's definitely received the most backlash. And I was wondering, do you find that in your work, that there's a bit of a denial or a head-in-the-sand syndrome when it comes to some of these environmental issues?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's time and again I hear that we're clever, that we cannot and will not do anything that will contribute to our own demise, that we obviously depend upon the living planet, so we aren't going to hurt that. Or at the other extreme, we don't even need other species. We'll engineer our way into and out of anything at all. So yes, there's a tremendous amount of discord, we'll say, created by my work.
I mean, it's better to get to the truth, though. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I can't say I'm any better. You know, I eat things that I know are bad for me. We all carry cell phones and sit next to Wi-Fi routers, and there seems to be a lot of data accumulating that those aren't very safe things to do. So I guess I'm just as big of a hypocrite in some areas.
Well, you know, at some level, I'm going to quote my friend Timothy Scott Bennett here, we're all born into captivity, right? I mean, we were born into this set of living arrangements. And in many cases, there is little or nothing we can do short of moving to a cave and sucking the guts out of bugs that makes any difference at all. So we're stuck here. We're born into captivity. We didn't choose when we're going to be born and where we're going to be born. And we're born into this civilization.
Right. That's a great way to say it. And we don't have the education on what it would take to live a more sustainable lifestyle. And that's a sad piece of the puzzle and an important piece as well. But I mean, like any topic that involves a lot of money being made at the expense of things that are far more important, there's a ton of misinformation and propaganda out there about how bad things really are. I mean, corporations and lobbyists are misleading us, governments misleading us. So it's hard to know to what extent this problem, how far it goes. But if you can, give us a better understanding of the general health of the planet. I mean, is Earth terminally ill at this point?
Well, I think Homo sapiens is terminally ill. I think that because we're driving roughly 200 species a day to extinction, that's going to have some consequences, that we are, as near as I can tell, destroying every aspect of the living planet that we need to survive. And so it's no surprise that at some point, the species we take into the abyss is us. So we're fouling the air and dirtying the water and washing the soils into the world's oceans at an astonishing rate. That's going to catch up with you at some point. And I think we see plenty of evidence that the catching up is underway. For example, and it's just one example, but on the climate change front, we're seeing events play out in real time that previously have happened at a geological time scale. We've triggered 30 self-reinforcing feedback loops.
Right.
Including firing the clathrate gun or the methane bomb in the Arctic. And it doesn't end there by any means. I mean, industrial civilization apparently forces us to go into human population overshoot deeper every day by adding more than 200,000 people to the planet. That's births minus deaths. And by polluting the air and the water and destroying the soils and all those things that we do that ultimately lead to such wonders as iPods and smartphones. And apparently that's a trade-off we're willing to make and have been willing to make for a long time.
Well, you know, one thing that I had heard you say recently in the cases of pollution, which I thought was really scary, is it takes 40 years for the effects to manifest in the environment. Is that true? I mean, that seems like a pretty damning situation because we've perpetually damaged it more, especially in the past 40 years.
Right. And so that's with respect to carbon dioxide emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, the primary one of which is carbon dioxide. It's 40 years between cause and effect, between emissions and temperature rise. So the temperature rise we are seeing today is a result of emissions from 1974. And we've emitted more carbon dioxide in the last 29 years than in the previous 236 years of industrial civilization. So none of those are baked in yet. I mean, they're baked into the cake. They're underway, but we haven't observed the outcome.
Gosh, that is terrifying.
So you're right. That's horrifying. It's very damning. In that there's nothing we can do about it now. We can't go back and undo those emissions. And we haven't even begun to see the temperature rise that will result from those emissions.
Wow.
On the plus side, from an individual perspective, and I think this is really important, on the plus side, what that indicates to me is that we're not to blame. You and I, we had essentially nothing to do with it. Not only are we born into captivity, and so we don't even get a choice about when and where we're born and what sort of conditions under which we're born, but in 1974, I wasn't even driving yet. 40 years ago, I was not driving a car. I certainly was looking forward to driving a car. I thought that was going to be awesome. And also bear in mind that most of us didn't really know anything about climate change in 1974. So I don't hold you and me responsible.
That's a good point.
For actions that we took when I was an early teenager.
Hey, well, I'm always willing to accept an excuse to blame shift. But tell me about this Arctic methane bomb you had mentioned. I have not heard much about that.
Well, it was the first self-reinforcing feedback loop widely reported in the scientific literature, in the referee journal literature. And
these methane hydrates or clathrates are little cages of methane, and the methane is in cold storage at the at relatively shallow depths in the Arctic Ocean. And they're found a lot of other places too. They're, for example, they're found in the Antarctica at relatively shallow depths in the ocean. But these things are just sitting down there and have been sitting down there for a long time, millions of years. And with, as reported in the journal literature, relatively minor increases in temperature would cause upwards of 16,000 tons of methane to be released each year. That's from the June 2010 issue of Geophysical Research Letters. Well, as it turns out, we haven't experienced a minor increase in temperature in the Arctic. We've experienced a pretty major increase in temperature at the Arctic. And as a consequence, those methane clathrates, having been warmed, are now floating up to the surface. And as they warm even more, the clathrate or the cage breaks away. And so the methane is emitted directly into the atmosphere. How important is that? Well, methane is, in the short term, meaning less than 20 years, more than 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, molecule for molecule. So it appears that starting in 2007, there was more than 10 million times the amount of energy per year necessary to dissociate subsea Arctic methane hydrates. So starting in 2007, the clathrate gun went off. And because there was enough energy in the ocean, enough warming in the ocean to start those clathrates bubbling up. Even NASA's CARV project in the summer of 2011 was pointing out very large methane plumes, 150 kilometers across, in fact. And that's as of mid-July 2013, mid-July of last year. So the CARV project had been going on for a while. As of last summer, they documented 150 kilometer across plumes rising out of the Arctic Ocean. Obviously, they didn't do that with a boat right there in the midst of it. You would have been able to see methane as far as you could see in every direction, but then you would have been dead because methane is lethal at those concentrations at that proximity. So they observed this with satellite imagery. So these plumes have been coming up out of the Arctic Ocean, and they're large. And it appears we fired the clathrate gun about 7 years ago. And that's the self-reinforcing feedback loop that James Hansen particularly worried about in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. And so this is a big, big deal. And it's been documented in the refereed journal literature for about 4 years now that methane hydrates are bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean. And we've had enough energy for 7 years to cause them to bubble out at an accelerating rate. And so one analysis conducted by Sam Karana of those methanes, of the methane plume, indicates that it's gone exponential. And as a consequence, we'll have more than 4°C warming on the planet by 2030. That's important because there have been no humans on a planet at 3.5°C above baseline. And we're headed for 4°C. And an exponential polynomial curve fit to the data and forecast into the future indicates, based on that one feedback alone, we're headed for more than 10°C warming by 2040.
Wow. Yeah, that's also scary. And I know you said there's up to 30 of these different feedback loops, which just piles on an already scary situation. But let me ask you about some of these specific areas of environmental concern, and maybe you can help shed some light on the damage assessment in those areas for me. Let's start with fracking. I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me that the majority of people who tend to say it's harmless, they have some ties to the industry almost always. People are lighting their drinking water on fire. That seems hard to argue against. But how much environmental damage is this practice really causing?
It's obviously hugely detrimental to water. It requires a tremendous amount of water to implement fracking, and the fracking itself contributes to water that, when it comes out of the tap, can be lit on fire. And this is pretty well documented in places like Wyoming, where they first really started getting rolling with this hydrofracturing idea, and more recently in Pennsylvania. So I think if you can light your water on fire when it comes out of the tap, that's probably not a good thing. I wouldn't be drinking that water. And in fact, those people aren't. So they are instead shipping in their water, trucking it in, so they have water to drink. And talk about unmitigated disaster. So now if we're burning more fossil fuels, so you can have water.
To bring back the water that was already there.
Right. And we need more fossil fuels to maintain the set of living arrangements. Always have to have more. And so it's clear that we're willing to destroy even drinking water for ourselves, just so we can have a little bit more fossil fuels at our disposal. What do we use it for? To haul ourselves water. It's absurd.
Yeah. I mean, the whole fracking thing seems like a real play of desperation. Oil companies seem to be taking much greater costs and risks to keep up with this demand. And it seems pretty evident that we are exhausting the last few options for oil extraction, doesn't it?
Certainly seems that way to me. We are, if we're willing to go to those lengths to have a little bit more, and in the grand scheme of things, the shale bubble is a little bit more, the hydrofracking bubble is a little bit more. It's a little bump on a curve that's going down, way down. So if we're willing to do that, things must be pretty dire. This is tight oil.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of oil that we didn't used to have to go after. Like Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico, we didn't used to have to go 7 miles below the ocean surface and then another mile deeper below the seafloor to get oil. That's how desperate we are.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of analysis about the peak oil situation and what year will be out. And of course, there's a lot of factors that ebb and flow, so it's tough to really know. But it does seem like it seems like I'll see it in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's inconceivable to me that we won't see that within the next few years. I think we're already seeing consequences from an economic perspective. And that's what expensive oil does, is it throws sand into the gears of industry. And so what that means is, well, we have a Wall Street advisor who about 3 or 4 weeks ago, refusing to be identified, said that the unemployment rate in the United States is not 6.6%, as is officially reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In fact, it's 37.2%. Well, that's about 50% more than at the depths of the Great Recession.
Yeah.
That's a big number. So you can't tell me there's not a lot of people feeling the impacts already. We're well within the age of contraction, of economic contraction.
Yes. Well, let's talk about the oceans a little bit more. I mean, outside of these huge methane releases, there's definitely other concerns. I mean, the Gulf oil spill did some damage. I don't even know if it's still leaking or not. But outside of the methane releases, what do you see are some of the biggest oceanic concerns right now?
Well, ocean acidification is a huge phenomenon and is massively underreported. Ocean acidification results from carbon dioxide being absorbed by the oceans. So the oceans are absorbing that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And what that means is it's essentially turning into carbonic acid. Carbonic acid, so it's becoming increasingly acidified. And so what are the consequences of that? Well, we're already seeing coral reefs die as a result of bleaching, acidification, and higher temperatures. We're seeing the phytoplankton die, and that's been attributed to the acceleration of acidification. So we're at 0.85 degrees centigrade above baseline. We've already seen ocean acidification that has caused half or more of the phytoplankton to die in the world's oceans within the last few decades. Well, we're headed for 3 or 4 C in the relatively near future. You can only imagine what the consequences will be for ocean acidification. We're at just under 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now, and there's no indication that anybody is interested in stopping. And you know, we're at 280 parts per million at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when we had all of the phytoplankton with great abundance in the ocean, and therefore a tremendous number of fish that now it's almost impossible to find. Look in Benjamin Franklin's journals from when he floated across the Atlantic Ocean going to Europe, and he describes the fish being so abundant, the ocean fish, that they were smacking into the ship. You basically couldn't get away from the damn things. They were an inconvenience.
Yeah. Wow. And, you know, there's a lot of concerns about overfishing, too. Throw that on the pile. I mean, I've heard people say that we'd be almost out of fish by 2025. That's a weird thought. I mean, combined with the acidification and everything else, we're doing everything we can to make that just a dead pool of nothing, right?
That's right. And Jeremy Jackson gives a great TED Talk on the dying of the oceans. There have been people who are not scientists, who are just sailing across the oceans where they've been sailing for their entire lives, and they're reporting, hey, the ocean's all but dead. I can't find a living thing in there. There's the Pacific Gyre, the great Pacific garbage patch that is bigger than Texas.
Right.
There's, as you pointed out, the Macondo that blew up in the Gulf that probably will never be capped. There are thousands of other wells that are decomposing, degrading, that are allegedly capped, but they are not going to last forever. You know, we cap them and we walk away, and there's no monitoring system for those. Nobody's paying any attention. And the laws of thermodynamics indicate that the things break down, and that includes right. capped wells.
Yeah, yeah, jeez, man. Let's talk about Fukushima. I mean, that's another huge man-made disaster, and there seems to be a ton of mainstream downplaying and censorship on the issue. I mean, I've had some people tell me it's the largest environmental disaster in recorded history, and others have said that anybody who worries about it, they just don't understand how harmless radiation is, which sounds ridiculous, but again, it's tough for an average guy to know. I mean, how bad is Fukushima in your assessment?
Fukushima is really, really bad. I'm not a nuclear engineer. I'm not a nuclear scientist. So I'm going to quote some other people here. MSNBC tried to stifle news anchor Sink Ugar, and I'm pretty sure I'm not pronouncing that name right. And that's been well documented. Nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen pointed out in October 2013 that governments were withholding the truth about stillbirths, deformities, and health defects, and also were suppressing studies on deformed animals. Dr. Timothy Mousseau, a nuclear ecologist, gives an overview of nuclear nightmares in March 2013. He documents the destruction and demise of animals in the Chernobyl exclusion zone being as leading up to extirpation, that's local extinction. With respect to Fukushima, in early September 2013, he said, quote, given the vast amounts of material that was released, I think there will be measurable amounts of radioactive cesium hitting the West Coast, blanketing the West Coast for some time to come. Christina Consola indicates that billions of people could die from release of ionizing radiation just from Fukushima alone. Billions. Billions of people. That was in August 2013. September 2013, Yale professor Charles Perrow concluded that events at Fukushima could lead to fission of fuel rods, and, quote, all of humanity will be threatened for thousands of years. October 2013, Canadian scientist David Suzuki, who most people know, adds his voice to the conversation, calling Fukushima, quote, the most terrifying situation I can imagine. It's already terrifying for the 71 sailors assigned to the USS Ronald Reagan who responded to the Fukushima disaster for 4 days after the meltdown in March of 2011. They've reported radiation sickness. They're filing a lawsuit against TEPCO. At least half of those sailors have contracted some form of cancer. These are very young people in the prime of their lives. 37 of them, of the 71 who are sick, have already contracted some form of cancer. That's as of a few months ago. So it's horrifying. It represents a significant threat to human life in the Northern Hemisphere for thousands of years to come.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a depressing thought, but I've heard about all the different possible effects being so exponential, things people don't even think about. You know, a bird eats a radioactive fish and then is shitting on your car. Of course, it's in the weather, but the food supply is just the real scary thing. You know, an over-radiated fish eats a smaller fish, and now it's compacted, and that gets put into our food supply. Man, it seems like it's really interwoven and almost impossible to weed out at this point.
Yes, it is, and it's worse than that. It's not just us eating fish. It's us eating pretty much anything. If you drink milk, for example, where does that milk come from? It comes from a cow. Where does that cow come from? What does it eat? It eats the alfalfa. Where does the alfalfa come from? The alfalfa is grown in a field that was either directly watered by rain falling out of the sky, Fukushima rain, or it was irrigated with river water that's contaminated with Fukushima radiation. I think you'd be hard-pressed at this point to find any milk in North America that did not have measurable quantities of ionizing radiation.
Oh my God, man, that's scary stuff. I had milk before this interview.
Right, and it just goes up the food chain, right? I mean, yeah. The whole thing biomagnifies as it goes up the food chain. So, yeah, you're drinking milk, you're eating eggs. It doesn't really matter what you ate. Whatever you ate something else, or drank something else, or got the water from somewhere else, and then somewhere else is contaminated with ionizing radiation from Fukushima.
Man, so, I mean, on this subject...
So, there's no escape.
Okay, yeah, that was my question, is if there was going to be any... If there's any type of supplements or any type of pill you can take, like I've heard about iodine or something, you could take to offset those?
Yeah, you can take potassium iodide. Sure, you can take potassium iodide, and that will reduce the risk of certain kinds of cancer.
Hmm. Well,
but
better than nothing, I guess.
Well, right. And so you can eat seaweed, for example, which is really high in Ki and potassium iodide. And that will save your thyroid for a while.
For a while.
But you have to make sure, of course, that the seaweed came out of an area that was not already affected by Fukushima. So
great.
Right. So you have to go back and find the old stuff. And all of this indicates to me that, well, first of all, we're in the age of economic contraction. So it becomes increasingly difficult to deal with things like Fukushima and to deal with San Onofre, the exact same design of nuclear power plant, GE design, in Southern California. And so when it was closed down in a hurry, it was the cooling ponds, the water in them was held in with plastic and broomsticks.
Wow.
And duct tape.
I did not know that.
You know, we're in the age of economic contraction, so we just don't have any money to throw at these big projects like we did in the age of expansion. And so at some point, all of the world's 400 and some nuclear power plants go Fukushima.
Well,
if they don't, if we maintain the set of living arrangements forever, if we maintain industrial civilization forever, it makes carbon dioxide emissions and methane emissions and all other greenhouse gas emissions much, much worse. Increasingly worse every year. So those are your choices. You get to ratchet up climate change, which is going to kill us in the near future, or you get to stop climate change by collapse of industrial civilization. And then we all get to die from ionizing radiation.
Great. Well, I mean, yeah, if this wasn't enough, let's talk about global warming and some of these extreme weather events. That's another area where skeptics will tell you that the only reason hurricanes and tsunamis and these things seem worse these days is because the scope of recorded history when compared to the life of the Earth is such a small sample size. And this type of cycling might be pretty average by comparison. I mean, is that a valid argument or are these people missing the boat?
Well, at some level, it is a valid argument. And that's why climate scientists are so reluctant to attribute any single event, no matter how horrific, to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that's right. However, we're seeing an increased and increasingly frequent series of these extreme events. Each of those extreme events, by the way, contributes to more climate change. Let me give you an example. We have a hurricane, say, that sweeps up from the Atlantic and batters the eastern seaboard of the United States. Well, one of the consequences of that battering is that a bunch of trees die. A bunch of them lose their limbs, they fall off, and then a bunch of trees die. And so what's the consequence of that? Well, all of a sudden we don't have those trees sequestering carbon anymore. Now they're contributors of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. They're not taking CO2 up. They're giving it up. They aren't sequestering it through photosynthesis. They're decomposing instead. So every one of those storms contributes to more tree death and therefore acceleration of the cycle. Certainly we've had events like this within Earth's history. But here's a couple of things we haven't had within human history. A few examples. We're at 396 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's the global average right now, 396 parts per million. That hasn't happened in the last 20 million years. We've had humans on the planet for about 2 million years. So we're in uncharted waters here. Methane levels in the atmosphere, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, were about 700 parts per billion. Now they're routinely measured at nearly 2,000 parts per billion, and the average is up over 1,800 parts per billion. That's 2.5 times we ever experienced in human history before. Those are just two of the greenhouse gases we're emitting. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the global average temperature was about a little over 14 degrees centigrade. Now it's at 15 degrees centigrade. Doesn't sound like much, but as pointed out in October 1990 by the United Nations, 1C warming is truly catastrophic. It leads to self-reinforcing feedback loops, the kind of which we're seeing now, in fact. So we've been warned about this for a while. And we're in this arena of accelerating nonlinear climate change. We've had the warnings for a long time. None of this information that is coming out that I'm aware of, none of the projections going forward, none of this takes into account an excellent paper in Climatic Change published online in November 2009 by Tim Garrett that points out only complete collapse of this set of living arrangements avoids runaway greenhouse. Only complete collapse prevents runaway greenhouse. That was almost 5 years ago. And in the interim, we found out about all 30 of those self-reinforcing feedback loops.
Wow.
Yeah, reported by scientists.
Jeez, man. Well, let's just keep piling it on, I guess. Let me ask you about overpopulation in general, because of course 7 billion people is more than we've ever known, but I've heard a recent statistic that seems kind of hard to believe, but they say that if you took all 7 billion people and grouped them in line with the population density of New York City, we would all fit inside the state of Texas. And I'm not sure if that's true, but either way, I wonder if we really have too many people or if we just have too many people to keep doing things the way we've been doing them. What do you think?
Yes. I think that's exactly right. I've heard that figure several times, and I don't doubt that if we stack all the people like cordwood, we could fit them into Texas. And really, I think that's not a bad idea either. For 6.8 9 billion of them, and the rest of us can have the whole planet to play on.
I'm in.
So, it's the issue is not where we can fit physically. It's our footprint that it takes to keep us alive. So people tell me all the time, hey, I live in a city and I live in a really small apartment and I'm a vegetarian, so my footprint is really small. Okay, and then they tell me, and you live on 2.7 acres. We can't all go live on 2.7 acres because there's too many of us to live like you do and live on 2.7 acres. That's why I live in this small apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's think about that for a minute. What do you eat? Even if you're a vegetarian, it requires more than 3 acres of industrial agriculture to support simply the food you eat. More than 3 acres. The way I live takes 2.7 acres to feed 5 people because I practice high-intensity organic gardening instead of industrial agriculture. Industrial agriculture, if you eat meat, you're up to at least 6 acres that it requires you to support. That is required to support you, rather. And so that means that if you're living in a city in a really small apartment, taking public transportation all the time and eating low on the food chain, it still takes 3 acres to support your lifestyle. You can't escape that. Just because you live in the city doesn't mean you're not eating and that you're not consuming the planet to support your way of life. That's only for Americans, though, that 3 to 6 acres. You live anyplace else where they don't actually have the absurdity mastered like we do, and it takes less. Frequently when I speak on to high schools or on college campuses, I will have the students calculate their ecological footprint, and there's a simple online calculator that allows you to do that. And I have them calculate it based on how they're living right now. So for most of them, that means grid-tied electricity in a house with 3 to 6 people, and they eat a certain point on the food chain and on and off. And they discover that being an American requires somewhere between 4 and 7 Earths to support 7.1 billion people living like they do.
Huh.
And they go, whoa, that's horrible. That's awful. And then I say, well, yeah, it is. But a lot of it is something that you don't have any control over. So as an example, let's have you calculate your ecological footprint again and do it the exact same way, give all the same answers, except change the country you're from. Just pick a country, any country. And so some pick Kenyan, some pick Australia. Most of them pick countries that are not that dissimilar from ours in that they're westernized, industrialized countries. And what they find is that whereas it required, say, 5 Earths to support their lifestyle living in the United States, it only takes 2 if they're living in France. And it only takes 0.9 if they're living in Kenya. And they're really confused about that.
Right.
How can that be? They're living the exact same way. And I say, okay, how could that be? And we have a long discussion. And finally, we trip on to a few things that are different here in America than they are other places in the world. For one thing, anytime you go into a business in this country, any business at all, the temperature is set at the same level year round,
mm-hmm.
day and night.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get that in South Africa. You go to a store in South Africa, and it's the same temperature inside as it is outside. In addition, who has the most lethal killing force in the history of humanity? Yep, that's right. That's us. And I didn't vote for that.
No.
And nobody in the room voted for that, but that's what we got. That takes a tremendous toll on your ecological footprint. No, you didn't vote for that, but you got it anyway. And it isn't cheap to maintain the military-industrial complex. And even if you didn't vote for it, you got it. And so that's part of your ecological footprint living here in this country.
Right. Yeah.
And so there again for me, this points to a whole bunch of this is not our fault. A whole bunch of this is not the fault of you and me and that person living in Bismarck, North Dakota, who makes an honest effort to take the bicycle to work and all those kinds of things, right? We don't have any control over what the military is doing, and it gets worse every day. We don't have any control over what Congress is spending our money on. We don't have any control over so many aspects of this age of industry. They're going on without us. They'll continue to go on without us. We don't have a great deal of control over any of that, even if we wanted to. And I suspect most people are not willing to go the Tim Garrett route in climatic change and vote for complete collapse of industrial civilization.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, but I think since the Occupy movement, there's been a little more talk about smaller communities, self-sustaining, off-the-grid type living. I think that getting back to the land is making a big comeback these days.
I think it is too, and I'm a huge fan. And I think it's too late. Even if we all go back to the land, I think it's too late to undo those self-reinforcing feedback loops. 28 of those, 28 of the 30, are irreversible at temporal spans relevant to the human condition. So it's not something, again, that we have much control over at this point. When you kick a soccer ball on a soccer field, the friction from the grass slows it down pretty quickly, so it stops. But if you kick a soccer ball over a cliff, it doesn't stop.
Right.
And that's what we've done with respect to these self-reinforcing feedback loops.
Man, so I guess let's talk about maybe something we can do. I mean, I think it bothers people being left without hope. But then again, I mean, is it better for a guy in Guantanamo Bay to think he's getting out tomorrow when we all know he isn't? You know what I mean? But I guess if you were given a blank slate and someone said to you, "Guy, we got 7 billion people. We have the technologies and the resources we have right now. Help us out." I mean, is there any way that you could see making this work for everybody without sacrificing the future?
Well, I think a primary response, if I were king for a day, I would first and foremost shut down every nuclear power plant in the world as quickly as possible. Those are ticking time bombs, and they keep going off. And if we have anything we can do at all, one of the things that we could be doing is shutting down those nuclear power plants. And that might mean that people are without electricity for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't bother me at all. You know,
right.
We lived for 2 million years without electricity. There's still a whole lot of people on the planet who live without electricity and couldn't care less. I think it's a luxury to have electricity for a few hours a day. I think that's amazing. And in my youth, in the small backwoods redneck logging town where I grew up in northern Idaho, the power would go out. And it wasn't a big deal. The power would just go out. And it would come back on later. And almost nobody died within 20 minutes of the power going out. You know, it just wasn't that big a deal. I'm pretty sure we could get along that way right now without much hardship. But most people I know think it really, instead of being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of grid-tied electricity.
Right.
That's not what it says. Let's not assume that we're so entitled that every time we flip a switch, a light has to come on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing I would do, finally, to answer your question, is shut down every nuclear power plant in the world. There's more. I would love to take some action that involves carbon sequestration. And here I'm not thinking about geoengineering proposals that have been floated. I'm thinking about people actually doing permaculture and living differently than we're living today. I'm not under any delusion that that will save us. But I think it will get people closer to the planet upon which they depend. And it might even make them more content human beings as a result. So I would like to see people better connected to the planet they live on, better connected to the human communities that they're a part of, and stop treating the living planet as if it is ours to exploit. Those are a few of the things I'd like to see done.
Yeah. Yeah, those would be definitely great steps in the right direction. I mean, obviously, a lot of us are addicted to those modern conveniences and the 24-hour electricity and Wi-Fi, and that's a big problem. But there are people like Jacques Fresco and Peter Joseph who are kind of out on the fringe, but they say that there are technologies we could switch over to, like solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, etc., that if we fully realized those potentials, these people think they would sustain us on the planet without really impacting our energy needs. Is that possible, or is that too far-fetched in your assessment?
I used to think that was right, and I even wrote a book about it, proclaiming the glories of renewable energy. That book was published in 2004, and I subsequently came to my senses and realized that there are no renewables. There are no replacements. There are derivatives of the current fossil fuels. So it takes a lot of oil, as one example, to build a solar panel. It takes a lot of oil and other fossil fuels to build wind turbines and to distribute them all over the country. It takes a lot of oil to tap into geothermal resources. And then we build the electrical grid. All right, so now we have the grid. What does that take? It takes a tremendous amount of liquid fuels to maintain it. Because every time we have an ice storm, or every time the wind blows, or every time it gets too hot or too cold or too wet or too dry, there's some sort of maintenance that needs to be done on the grid. And that all requires liquid fuels at this point. So I don't see a way out of the monkey trap. We've caught ourselves in a monkey trap, and I don't see any way out at anything resembling a temporal span that catches up with those self-reinforcing feedback loops.
Interesting. Depressing, but fair. I mean, these are scary times, man. Like you mentioned, not only do we have all these environmental concerns, but the global economy seems to be on pretty shaky ground. Lots of people are paralyzed by debt. Unemployment is way too high. Corporations are posting hundreds of millions of dollars in profit, but they're paying their employees minimums or keeping them off of full time. When you factor in these concerns with the environmental situation, it's really hard to be optimistic about anything.
Well, yes, except we have this. We, you and I, and everybody listening to this program, we have a tremendous advantage that almost nobody and nothing in the history of the planet has ever had. We get to die. And that makes us the lucky ones, because it means we get to live. We get to live here now at the most amazing time in history. We get to see the end. We get to see the end of industrial civilization, and therefore a comeback by the living planet, unlike anything we've ever seen before. The alleviation of oppression will be astonishing. Not only that, we get to see the end. I can't imagine a situation in which we're not among the last humans on the planet. And
wow.
We get to live. The odds against DNA, we know a lot about DNA. We've been studying it for a long time. And we know the odds against any collection of DNA forming human beings, me and you, the odds against any of us being here ever exceed the odds against plucking a single atom at random from the entire universe. We know that there's between 10 to the 80th and 10 to the 100th atoms in the entire universe. The odds against plucking a single atom at random are far greater than the odds of DNA coming together in this form. I think that's pretty incredible. So let's live as if our lives matter. Let's pursue lives of excellence. Let's treat people as if they're decent and treat them humanely and act with kindness and compassion and do all those things that we say humans are great because they do. Let's do all those things instead of grubbing for another dime, instead of buying 15 pairs of shoes just because we can, because we have the world's reserve currency. Let's do all those things that make life better for humans and other organisms in the time we have left. Because even if we live to a very old age, the time we have left is not very long. I don't find many 100-year-olds saying, yep, I had a good run, I'm ready to die now. I think everybody remembers a few things. We have a few memories we take with us into the grave. We remember those moments, good, bad, otherwise, but there are relatively few of them that people remember, even if they live to a very old age. So let's try to create those moments. Let's try to create those moments of beauty and compassion and human greatness, really, where we actually exhibit our humanity in a manner that is positive, that looks good for us and for those we're interacting with.
Well said. I mean, and in that thread, to try to be positive and give the people just a little direction, let's assume, you know, we are going to face extreme weather and economic collapse and a decline of excess and our cushy American lives. I mean, how would you advise the people on a personal level? I mean, are there places to go on the planet or steps to take to increase those positive moments and be less impacted by the decline of everything?
Well, if you're going to if your goal is to extend your life and the lives of your family members for as long as possible, then I think among the last places to have habitat for humans on this earth will be south, way south. Places that are surrounded by a lot of water, that are a long way from nuclear power plants, that are the southern tip of Chile and southern Australia and New Zealand and southern South Africa, places like that. But even then, I'm guessing you don't buy yourself a very long time. So maybe we should take a little advice from Nietzsche here, live as though the day were here, to live as if we mattered, and so did the people around us.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, it's kind of like a bubble boy conundrum. You can protect yourself from everything, but at the cost of enjoying anything, you know?
Yes. Yes, I suspect that's exactly right. We can extend our own run as individuals for a little bit, but certainly not forever. Nobody gets out alive, right?
Right.
And so what does it mean? What does it mean to live well? Those are the kinds of questions that I'm interested in pursuing at this point.
Right. Like, how long do you want to live in the zombie apocalypse? Isn't it easier to just go?
Bingo. I mean, I'd kind of like to see the zombie apocalypse, obviously. It's such exciting stuff when you see it in the movies.
True.
But I'm not sure I want to be around for the end of the zombie apocalypse. I'm not sure I want to turn into one of those zombies.
Exactly. Man, well, that is pretty much enough positivity for me for one day. I feel like we should all go watch Shrek or Up or some kind of over-the-top feel-good movie now to bring us back out of the gutter. But hey, in some weird way, it was still a pleasure.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity being on. And people ask me all the time why I do this, why I do what I do. And part of it is that I think people have the right to know.
Yeah.
What the science is saying about our future. And another part is I'm really trying to encourage people to pursue this information with vigor. If this is the end, if you realize you don't have much time left, and I would argue that that's always been true, if that's the case, if you accept this information, if you take it in and internalize it, what does it mean? I suspect it means you're not living in a cube farm anymore, that you're not going to work to a job you hate and saving for a future that never comes.
Mm-hmm.
Either because we're in the age of contraction, so your retirement is going to be taken away from you, or because of climate change or ionizing radiation shortening your life more than you ever imagined possible. So I think this is incredibly liberating, and I've heard many people tell me the same thing. It's incredibly liberating. Now I can do the things I've really wanted to do, but culture was screaming at me to not do them.
Yes, 100% agree. I'm actually 30 days out of my 9-to-5 job, and it all just kind of came from this material. I thought, you know, if the economy does collapse tomorrow, I'm going to feel really silly going to a 9-to-5 job I hate for the past 2 decades.
Yes.
So I'm with you on that. I think that's a pretty, that's the most positive message anyone could gain out of this. If you don't have a lot of time, make the best of it and stop worrying about exactly how many seconds you can squeeze out of life on the planet. But hey, I very much respect your analysis and thank you for sharing everything you have with us, man. Would you like to tell the people about your website or where they can keep up with you before we let you go?
Sure. I suspect if you put Nature Bats Last into your favorite internet search engine, it'll take you right to my website. It's at guymcpherson.com. You can follow all my work there. That leads to all the essays I'm writing for other websites as well. And anytime somebody shoots video when I'm speaking, it appears there as well.
Very cool. All right. Well, thanks again, Guy. I mean, do what you can to enjoy the rest of your day. All right, man?
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the opportunity. You have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
There it is, guys. I hope the audio issues weren't too distracting. I think I do a lot of things well, but I don't have an audio guy, and I'm deaf in one ear, so I do the best I can until I find my Brian Redband. But it's always getting better, and I think it has to if we're going to be going for the gold. That said, Guy McPherson, Jesus. I know it's a bit overwhelming, but instead of tuning that out or channeling it into an angry comment to me about how depressing it is, channel it into an angry tweet to ExxonMobil or take a second to publicly shame Walmart. I mean, they make over $300 billion a year off forcing the prices so low that only companies that use the cheapest labor and materials on earth can be a player in their $300 billion marketplace, which I might also note is three times the amount it would take to end poverty in America. If we could somehow spend just a third less on shit at Walmart and give that directly to our poor, no more poverty. So fuck Walmart. Either way, the power lies only with the people, and we have to start applying some pressure and have fun with it. It's fun to publicly shame a corporation on Twitter. It feels a little dangerous. Tag me in those tweets, and I'll broadcast them to the 40,000 people gracious enough to follow us on Twitter. And we'll all have a nice, comforting circle jerk. I love you guys. You're making my dream come true, and I think we're making progress in this fucked up world. Tomorrow I might feel like we're all fucked, but right now, progress. That's what I feel. Now, I was editing this episode and reflecting on the implications of its information, and this song No Children by the Mountain Goats pops up on my iTunes. And if you don't know it, it's the most angry and depressing, but truthful and honest breakup song that I know of. And as I was thinking about all the lyrics as a symbolic message to the earth and nature and our own humanity, I thought it really clicked. So I'll leave you with it. If we collectively wrote a song that captured the message we're giving to the natural world with our own actions until we make some radical changes, it would probably sound a lot like this, for better or worse. Donate to the Money Bomb. Share the show where you can. You are the water that helps this little THC seedling grow. And I'll see you next week. Your move, humanity.
I hope that our few remaining friends give up on trying to save us. I hope we come up with a fail-safe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. I hope the fences we mended fall down beneath their own weight. And I hope we hang on past the last exit. I hope it's already too late. And I hope the junkyard a few blocks from here someday burns down. And I hope the rising black smoke carries me far away, and I never come back to this town again. In my life, I hope I lie and tell everyone you were a good wife. And I hope you die. I hope we both die. I hope I cut myself shaving tomorrow. I hope it bleeds all day long. Our friends say it's darkest before the sun rises. We're pretty sure they're all wrong. I hope it stays dark forever. I hope the worst isn't over. And I hope you blink before I do. I hope I never get sober. And I hope when you think of me years down the line, you can't find one good thing to say. And I'd hope that if I found the strength to walk out, you'd stay the hell out of my way. I am drowning. There is no sign of land. you are coming down with me, hand in unlovable hand, and I hope you die. I hope we both die.